We do have a quorum, but we have no chair and the vice chair is out of town. So might I suggest that we nominate one of you to serve as acting chair so that we can commence?
Here we go.
Until such time as either the tonight's business is completed or Commissioner Baglio shows up to assume his duties as the chair. So if somebody would want to make a motion and a second and
Richard Shattuck, it's my big chance.
Nominate Richard Shattuck to be temporary chair for tonight.
Second that.
All in favor?
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Done.
We're done.
All right.
Meeting is called to order.
You have a copy of the agenda?
I do.
Okay.
Okay. The agenda has been presented to the Planning Commission. Commission members, do I have a motion to adopt the agenda as presented?
Also moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Second, moving to the approval of minutes. With regard to the minutes, the last meeting was the joint meeting with the commissioners, and I don't believe we have any minutes from that meeting. And we did we have meeting of those minutes?
The minutes that need to be approved are from the previous meeting.
From March 7th.
Correct.
Okay.
And those were posted.
Okay, so we've had an opportunity to review the March 7 minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the March 7 minutes as presented?
Move to approve the minutes.
Okay.
Second that.
All in favor? Okay. Okay. Right. Right. The minutes are approved unanimously. Next, we have on the agenda administrative reports. I understand we have no administrative reports this evening. And so we'll move into our,
Acting Chair, members of the Commission, we have a last-minute item, and it's an announcement. We just actually come to that conclusion this Monday, so that's why it's not on the list. I'd like to let you all know that Mr. Jim Bolger is the fortunate candidate and for the assistant director position. So he's now immediately take effect that he's now the assistant director for the long range and current planning division. We're very fortunate to have him. He has an extensive background, used to be an assistant director for the county, and we desperately need his help right now to really strengthen the department and continue with a lot of the co-amendment and all the long range projects that we need to move forward. So I just want to let you know that. The other thing is we promised to give you the work program, department work program, at the joint meeting. We noticed there were a couple of errors, so we just corrected that. And right now we are going to post it online. So what I'll do is actually email you the link. And please feel free to take a look at the projects that you are interested in. And if you have any questions, let us know. That's all we have for tonight. Thank you.
Okay, now we'll move into a public hearing, work study, and findings of fact on the Howard Open Space application. Holly Roberts presenting.
Good evening. My name is Holly Roberts. I'm a planner with the Kitsap County Department of Community Development. I'm here this evening to present an open space application for John and Sharon Howard. The property owners no longer meet the criteria for qualifying for the current use agricultural classification and have requested to transfer to the open space and farm and agricultural land program. The Howards have applied to transfer a total of 14.37 acres into the open space program. 12.43 of the 14.37 acres are currently classified by the assessor as current use agricultural. The additional 1.94 acres is not currently designated as open space and is fully taxable. Approval of this application would move 12.97 total acres into the open space traditional farm classification and 1.4 acres into the open space general classification. The property consists of five contiguous parcels totaling 15.37 acres, One acre has been removed for the home site and driveway access. All five properties are zoned rural protection. These parcels are located at 9931 Bethel Burley Road Southeast, Port Orchard, South Kitsap County Commissioner District Number 2. RCW provides for certain properties to be taxed on their current use rather than their highest and best use. The open space classification may be applied to land that protects streams or water supply and land that is traditional farmland that has not been irrevocably devoted to use inconsistent with agricultural uses and that has a high potential for returning to commercial agriculture. This application has been found to be eligible for a 60% reduction to the land value, 50% for a minimum of two priority resources, and 10% for the applicant choosing to grant appropriate public access. Property qualifying for the current use open space designation must have at least two sensitive characters or resources. This property has three high priority resources and one low priority resource. Transferring from the current use agricultural program to the open space program actually increases the taxes paid by the applicant by $782.28 per year. Transferring this property to the open space program will result in a total tax shift of $1,395.72. We have received no public comment regarding this application, and staff is recommending approval of this open space application as conditioned in the staff report dated March 9th, 2017. At this time, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
I have one question.
Sure. I have one question. On the home site, the map, the picture you showed did not have any home site excluded in there. Now, but there's the picture.
Correct. Yes, this is the total site here. And let me get my mouse to show up over here. Well, this is the total property. The driveway runs along the bottom of the most westerly lot. It runs along the bottom of that parcel, and then lot 027 contains the home site. So the majority of that home site is excluded. And the most southerly portion of the most westerly lot is also excluded for the driveway access. And I believe the staff report may have a better site plan. Oh, no, it doesn't. But hold on one second.
I'm satisfied with the answer.
Oh, okay. I can show it up on the projector if you'd like, but it is the bottom of that most westerly lot. And then lot 027 that has the home site. Any other
questions? Okay. Okay. And so, thank you, Tom. Is there anyone in the audience or any members of the public who would like to testify on this hearing this evening on this matter?
The applicant is here if you have any questions.
Okay, so going once, going twice. Okay, the public hearing portion of this meeting is hereby closed. Okay, next, are we ready to any discussion among the commission?
For a motion on this, and I will move that the Planning Commission approve this application.
Second.
Okay, and so as I understand, Tom, your motion would include adopting the findings of fact as presented by Ms. Roberts this evening.
Okay. See them. I think they're online.
Okay, great. Okay. So all in favor of approval of the application, including the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendation as presented by staff this evening, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So I want to thank you for working with the county and preserving property like that. So I appreciate it. Thank you. There we go. Okay, make sure I got the right folks.
The clerk of the commission has the findings of fact for you to sign.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Good, thank you. Somebody scratch out the So at this point, we'll go ahead and move to discussion of the critical areas ordinance. And is Kathleen here? There we go. Hi, Kathleen.
Well, good evening once again, Planning Commission. My name is Kathleen Barnhart. I'm with Kitsap County's Department of Community Development, Senior Planner. I'm going to go over a work study tonight about the Critical Areas Ordinance update. And I want to run through a couple things first, primarily kind of our schedule and how we're going to go over the next two work studies. We're breaking it up into two pieces for you before we go into hearing. And then we can work this a couple of ways. We can either go do a line-by-line review. I can answer your questions as you've now had time to review the draft, however you want to approach that. But we'll start with the schedule. So we have two work studies, as I mentioned, this evening, as well as on the April 18th. We have hearings scheduled for you at your request. We have three of them. April 25th will be at the Fairgrounds in the President's Hall. The second one will be April 27th at the Poulsbo City Hall. And May 2nd, which is a regular meeting, will be here in Port Orchard. Deliberations we have scheduled all day for May 16th, May 23rd if needed, and then findings of fact in the beginning of June, June 6th. So as I mentioned, we've broken this up in two pieces. April 4th tonight, we're going to be going over the public comments and open house and let you know how that went. We just closed our first public comment period. We're going to go over Chapter 100, Introduction and Approval Procedures, the definitions chapter, as well as the wetlands chapter. The remainder will be on April 18th. It looks a little lopsided, and that's because most of the comments we're receiving are within that first half that we're going to be talking about this evening. So with the public participation we've had, as I mentioned, we've had our initial draft available for review March 1st through the 31st, so that just wrapped up. We had our traditional standard open houses. We have one in each commissioner district later in the month. So Kingston, Port Orchard, and at the Fairgrounds. In total for those, we had about 68 attendees for those. We also had a somewhat new, non-traditional online open house. And that number is significantly updated. As of yesterday afternoon, we had received 698 hits to the online open house. So 698. It's I'm very pleased with the results, and I hope the public found it useful as well. The online open house is going to stay open, going to stay up. The comment form that's on there has been disabled until we begin a new comment period. Any questions on that portion?
And when will you finalize the matrix for that, all that input? I mean, What is your timeline on that?
So we're in the process of preparing that comment response matrix by both summary of each comment as well as by theme. So if you wanted to just see kind of in total what are the themes and what's the counter response, or if you want to see each individual commenter's a response for those. So we hope to have that available April 17th for an additional public comment period. So the public will have an opportunity to comment on the county's responses to their comments as well prior to the hearing process. So in your materials, you have received a preliminary comment matrix. So during the 30-day comment period in total, we had 20 comment submissions. 14 of those, by the way, were online. That equates to hundreds of individual comments. So there may have been 20 commenters, but there are many, many comments. So we're processing those right now and formulating some responses. In general and overwhelmingly, I'd say most of the comments were on existing language, not on the proposed changes. So that's something else to keep in mind.
May I interrupt just a second? The comments were on existing language, but this critical area ordinance is open for review only once in a while. So those comments are received with intent that they were delivered and the staff will look at them seriously?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, as we kind of move through each section, it'll be easiest if you can follow along in your copy of the draft, and hope you all brought that with you. I'd also like to open this up for your discussion. If you would like to go through this line by line, we're prepared to do that. If you would prefer to just ask questions, we can also do that as well.
My question is this really, you don't want to do anything that might be substantive as far as requiring motions. This all has to happen after the open house and the hearings that come. Then the Planning Commission will be suggesting motions for change based on the comments that we receive. We won't be doing this now at this point. You're just looking to see if we understand what we are reading. Is that right?
I believe so, yes.
We're just in a work study now, so we're going to time to us. Yeah. Good. Okay. So that's my understanding, too. No votes.
So would you like to proceed?
Yes, yep. Right ahead.
So we'll start with, at the beginning, of course, Chapter 100, the Introduction and Approval Procedures. So in Section 110, under applicability, under D, so this subsection was changed because the county does not require, I'm sorry, this is on page 4, line 13. This subsection was changed because the county actually does require critical area specific permits in addition to those required in Title 21, such as the danger tree permits, critical area variances, critical area buffer reductions, and reasonable use exceptions are very specific to critical areas. So we changed that. Moving on then to, I did want to point out that we also did receive several comments on this section as well, just so you're aware of that. I believe this is a misinterpretation. Some of the concerns were that this would prohibit gardening or weeding within the buffer, the critical area of the buffer, and that's simply not true. This language has been in the critical areas ordinance for well over a decade. So just so you're aware that has been brought up. And then under Section 120, Review Authority, these changes were made in Section D. For consistency with Title 21, there was the written request for a time extension is going from 60 to 30 days, and then written comments from 30 to 15 days.
And so what was the reason for that?
To be consistent with Title 21, so okay. We didn't have two different procedures going at the same time.
Okay. It would seem that this would be a good place to kind of beef up the source of the authority to, I know it comes from the Growth Management Act and other laws, but sometimes you like to see it in place, but that's just a point.
So then moving on to 125B, the exemptions, pre-existing and ongoing agriculture. So in the proposed change, we've added that it would be maintained within the past 5 years under a farm management plan or other best management practices, not resulting in net loss of critical area functions and values. And sorry, I lost my train of thought. These, we recognize that this language needs a little bit of work. We'll continue to do that, and it's very similar. It goes along with the rules that are in the wetlands chapter as well as the fish and wildlife habitat chapter. So we will be looking at that to make sure we're not
make sure we're consistent with some of the federal rules and programs that are in place for agriculture. And so we will be looking at that. This change is based on a Western Washington Growth Management Hearing Board decision in Clallam County, in which the hearings board determined that the county's broad exemption for pre-existing agricultural uses in critical areas were was not compliant with the Growth Management Act. And our language, as we have it today, is the same as Clallam County's was. It was found to be non-compliant. So this is we need to make sure we're taking advantage of this opportunity to change that language at this time.
And does that include the definition of best management practices? Was that really the problem? I know we've got a change in the definition you'll be getting to, but adding the soils issues and the vegetation issues, is that the problem?
That was part of it. The Department of Commerce actually in December of 2016 provided a guidance document for this issue as well. And they sort of had this, helped us formulate this no harm language that we've included in the draft. So that is part of it, yes. And section 130. So the standards for existing development under section A, we have struck the shorelines. As you may recall, the Shoreline Master Program is now the reviewing authority for shorelines. And then further on down in the new section B, danger tree removal in critical areas, we've added some clarification language. This is what is currently administered when it says the department may require the applicant. This language will not change current requirements or practices. It just clarifies the how, the means. So by saying that through a risk assessment report, which is something the arborist would provide, or by the department through a danger tree site evaluation permit prior to tree removal. And that site evaluation tree permit is essentially a means to get staff out on site to do that evaluation.
So on that one, I'm a little curious why we struck out property. And did we add in the habitable structure?
We did.
So if it's not a habitable structure, barn, shed, whatever, mm-hmm. it doesn't warrant the hazardous tree removal?
Not in critical areas.
Hmm. I find that a bit...
Yeah, I would agree. And then what else is, I guess, what is considered a habitable structure? Is it a garage? Anything?
We can look to clarify that.
So can I... This is Jim hiding behind Kathleen over here. So when we talk to our environmental review folks who implement the code currently, one of the things that they looked at with this new language that's being proposed is they will typically consider garages and barns and those kinds of things that have a lot of human activity associated with it and will assess them as, you know, potential threats to health and safety. But they also have seen folks who have like a pump house and they want to take out a danger tree in a critical area that's leaning or they feel potentially threatens that pump house. And so what people will do is they'll have used every structure to just clear trees. And so that's typically kind of the demarcation. If it's a structure that's housing, say, a wellhead, that's typically not considered to be a habitable structure. And so they wouldn't necessarily give it the same level of protection as a barn, a garage, or kind of a more actively used structure. So right now we do have the habitable structure, and that's a conversation that I think there's some flexibility with.
Thank you. And also on this, we're talking removal. Is there any provision for just having the tree fell and left in place as in a natural occurrence happens?
My understanding, and I will follow up in the critical areas, that is often what is done through the permitting process, through the site evaluation, to make sure that those...
Do we address that anywhere within the critical ordinance?
But there is the very last sentence, Jim, that provides that you can leave it if it's helpful to the habitat of the on the existing for danger trees. Habitat may require leaving the falling tree. Okay.
There is a... Oh, no, we're not there.
So moving on then to page 11, section 145, special use review. This was a section that was moved from being solely in the wetlands chapter to this chapter to establish special use review as applicable to other types of critical areas. And language was added at the beginning to clarify that this is a process for existing permits rather than a different permit type in and of itself. Any questions with that?
There's some questions that may be like editorial things, but they actually change the meaning of the sentence a little bit. But this would be back on 135 in under variance. Number one, it talks about properties in the vicinity. And to me, I don't have a definition for that, but I do have one for adjacent, and so does the county. But if you could think about using the word adjacent properties instead of in the vicinity properties, might be a little more precise.
Tom, I'd be really concerned about that if we're looking at the only relevant piece of property in terms of how it's being used is the one right next door. If you have the rest of the whole neighborhood able to do what you're asking to do, I think that limiting it to the one next door is...
Well, perhaps it's something that will have to do with a motion at some point, so we'll deal with that later. As long as we're on this same kind of topic, and in number three... granting of the variance will not result in substantial detrimental impacts. I'm curious how that gets measured. That's just a bit of a problem, but we'll deal with it later.
That's been noted, yes.
And number four, excuse me, I'll quit real soon. There's granting the variance the minimum necessary to accommodate the permitted use, and that could be a little confusing because some lots, like say the rural protection, have 1 to 5 homes allowed, but due to the impacts of a critical area, it may not be real easy to put more than one home on there. But if someone read that and says, well, I'm permitted to put 5, I should put 5. So that presents a bit of a problem for me, but we'll deal with that later also. Just cards on the table, folks. You can prepare your defense.
Yeah.
Moving on then to section 150 on page 12, appeals.
Yeah, but did we finish up with 145? I didn't quite understand this is a whole new process, the special use review? Mm-mm. Okay.
No, this section was actually in only the wetlands chapter.
Oh, okay. So we're not talking about, I thought we were talking about the variance section. So special use review. Got it. Okay.
Okay. So we can move on to the 150 appeals. I would say that in under B, the appeals process, we have removed that section in the existing Title 19. The process was removed, and a reference was added to the process that we have in Title 21, again, for consistency throughout code. And I threw on here the Section 155 notice to title, not because we are proposing any changes, but because it has come up in the public comment. I wanted you to be aware of it. This is an example of something that the county has a little more discretion over, and we will be considering. It was not a requirement from the state or anyone else, so we are going to be taking a closer look at that. But I wanted you to be aware of it because it has come up in comment.
Kathleen, when you say it's not a requirement of the state, can you help me just in terms of the process? Maybe everyone else understands it. So we have to have our development regulations match up with the comp plan amendment we did. And so we are getting direction. Somebody has read Kitsap County Code down at the Department of Commerce and has said, boy, here's the problems I see. So when you say the state or someone's telling us we need to address it, how is that process generated? Why isn't our code? The question is, why isn't our code good enough? Who's looking over our shoulder and saying, "Hey, you guys need to do this"? I understand if we have a growth management decision and hey, we're out of compliance. We as Kitsap County say, "Wait, we're going to bring into compliance." What it sounds like though is we've got somebody at the state who's reviewing our code, telling you as staff, "You need to change all this stuff, and here's the way you should change it."
In regards to notice to title, that is not.
No, but I mean just in general, in terms of the product. I just don't understand who they are, who's giving us the push in terms of you need to change these parts of your code.
There are state laws that require us to look at best available science, for example, and one of the definitions of that include the state guidance materials from the state agencies, which include Department of Ecology, Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Natural Resources.
Okay, so you're not having someone from the state that's looked at our code and said, here's the changes you need to make. It's you're looking at guidance from the Department of Ecology and says, here is what you should find generally in codes.
They aren't saying this is what you need to change. They are saying this is what we recommend as best available science, and it is up to the county then to determine how to balance that with other information that we may have.
So in some cases, they may say, you know, you will use this delineation manual for the state as the state guidance.
But then the stormwater manual. Okay, that's
right, or the wetland, you know, rating system will be used. But other than that, local jurisdictions have some level of discretion in selecting the best available science to inform the development standards. In some instances, some provisions within this draft code and the current code, and this notice to title is one example, the Board of County Commissioners, when they adopted the current code back in 2005 originally, they chose to include this notice to title provision in the code so that subsequent purchasers of property would be notified that there was a critical area ordinance present. But there isn't a state. There isn't state guidance to do this. We do have those resource agencies and other groups in the public as well who do review our draft code. We have received comments, say, from the Department of Ecology on the current draft. And that I think those are reflected in the matrix.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
I'd like to move on then to 160, general application requirements, on page 13. So this reflects some changes to, I believe, Title 17, where we've removed the definition for major versus minor development. So we've crossed out major new development, and there's no requirement for having a to meet with the department prior to application, so it's now just an encouragement, and then we've crossed out the encourage language for single-family dwellings since it's encouraged for all. And there were no further changes in this chapter. So moving on then to definitions. So as I mentioned previously, the agricultural piece we are going to be taking a closer look at, so I wanted to point that out. But it was determined that our current definition was too broad and would appear to even include residential gardening activities. So we want to make sure we hone in on that definition. So that's what you see in the draft today.
When you said it was, again, we say it's pointed out. Was it our local ag group that pointed this out, or was it some state group?
Just internal.
Our local, okay.
Internal.
So this point on adjacent will have some significance later on, but I noticed the definition here refers to a definition within just a few pages back. But it doesn't really align with Title 17, 110 definition. But, you know, that it's a little confusing when you have the same word meaning two different things within the code. So it's just a point to look at.
Aquaculture practices, again, this is something that's covered under the Shoreline Master Program. Oops. Best management practices. We have added a couple of line items there, realizing that point D there may be some redundancies there to some of the beginning ones, so we will go back and look at those. But wanting to add, that best management practices should include more than just water quality protections, but it's also best management practices for habitat and other biological characteristics. And that comes into play when we get to talking about agriculture and those requirements as well. With the definition for buffer, we have removed the native vegetation point. So it now means a non-clearing vegetation area that is intended to protect the functions and values of critical areas. This includes preservation of existing native and non-native vegetation where it exists, unless otherwise required to be replaced with native vegetation through mitigation. So recognizing that a buffer may already have a garden or vegetation on it that may not be native, we're not requiring someone to go through and replace it with native vegetation unless it's part of mitigation for their permit. the definitions for definition for creation was an update provided from Department of Ecology guidance again to go with the wetland rating system and the other documents that they have. Critical aquifer recharge areas was an update to the definition from the WAC. And critical facilities, we struck the portion that talked about Chapter 14 of County Code just because it mentions essential facilities that are defined in that chapter, but that chapter didn't really define what essential facilities were. So we struck that and just said it's including but not limited to, and then it lists the existing uses provided in that definition. And then moving on to danger trees. we've added an immediate hazard to the public or habitable structure. So that could include trees that are overhanging roads that could be a danger to the public. So it's not just the structures.
And the use of the word immediate, we've added that. And so if something's a hazard, but it's not going to fall until next winter season, you know, the arborist comes out and says, well, it'll make it through mm-hmm. the summer. Mm-hmm. But, and so is that immediate? I'm not sure, why did we add the word immediate? If it's a hazard, it's a hazard. Why does it have to be an immediate hazard?
Well, that's something that would be determined by the licensed arborist. So that's still part of that definition.
Okay. So if the arborist says, well, you know, it's not going to come down this summer, but I'm concerned about it next winter, that would not be an immediate hazard, so no cutting right now. I'm not sure I understand why did we add that word. Has there been problems? Have there been people who have been coming in and saying, look at this thing's hanging over my house, but I can't say it's really going to fall this winter? So if it's not a problem, why do we make it harder?
Yeah. We'll look into that. Any other questions on Danger Tree? So the definition for enhancement, again, is coming from Department of Ecology and their wetland documents as well. We have another agricultural definition under 295, which is existing and ongoing agriculture. We added that means activities in existence as of January 1, 2000, and that is because that was the date 5 years prior to the 2005 adopting ordinance. As you see, the language below that we struck, that just says that have been conducted within the last 5 years. This is an approach that many jurisdictions have been taking to address some of these existing and ongoing agricultural issues that have come up.
Okay, Kathleen, now on the second part of that, this is where I'm kind of concerned. You go back, okay, so for ongoing agriculture, we have to use best management practices.
Mm-hmm.
And we go back to best management practices, and we change the definition to include only native trees, only native vegetation. So under best management practices section C, the new section,
mm-hmm.
we got to have native species. And boy, it seems to me, especially in the area of agriculture, native species may be great for protecting a forest, may not be great at all for an agricultural setting.
Mm-hmm.
So why did we add C if it doesn't apply all the time?
That's a good point, and we can look at that again. And I think it comes to that it's appropriate for the site for revegetation of disturbed areas, but if you're talking agriculture, that wouldn't necessarily apply because the agricultural use is that's what's happening.
Buffering for plants, I don't know. But I guess I'm just concerned we're adding kind of requirements that doesn't really apply then. What circumstance would we have where we have to make sure we have native plants in an agricultural setting?
So I don't think in the case of best management practices that one best management practice necessarily would be appropriate for all particular uses. So there are ag BMPs, for example. There may be BMPs that would be applicable in other situations, like around stream corridors or places like that adjacent to a different type of land use activity. But
not under this code. The best management practice is a defined term. And it doesn't say, I guess you would have to get a variance. If I want to use, because best management practices doesn't say if you're in an ag zone, you don't have to go A, B, C, and D.
Yeah, you wouldn't necessarily have to apply all of those things to be part of the best management practices that are perhaps prescribed in a farm plan, for example. They may be looking at best management practices associated with livestock keeping or tillage or those kinds of things. So necessarily revegetation may not be appropriate in an ag type setting.
Feeder bluff. That was another one removed because that was very specific to the shoreline. Fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas. That is a definition coming out of the WAC that was updated, as well as forest practices, an update to the WAC. We have added functions and values. It comes up a lot in code, so we wanted to get that in there as sort of a clarification. You know, things that it would include but not limited to. So those have been added. Also added, geologic assessment is the umbrella term used for the evaluation completed by a geologist or a geotechnical engineer to meet the requirements of Chapter 400. And that could be in the form of a letter, or a geological report, or a geotechnical report. So it's just an umbrella term. groundwater, that was an updated definition as well from the Department of Ecology's guidance materials. And impervious surface was added. It largely matches that in Title 12, but it comes up frequently in this portion of code, so we wanted to include that. Kind of coming in the opposite direction then, the definitions for lot, non-conforming use or structure, open space, performance-based development, and permit may not be used as often in this chapter, and they are defined in other portions of county code, so that definition would apply. And we do this to avoid the potential for having multiple definitions for the same term throughout county code to reduce that confusion. Priority habitat was updated. This is from Department of Fish and Wildlife's most recent Priority Habitats and Species Guidance document from 2008. We changed the definition for reasonable use. And that simply is because there has been no legal definition found for this. It's sort of playing out as a concept through the legal system. So there's no real firm definition there, so we wanted to clarify that. User activity was moved, which you'll see. So it's not really struck out, it's just moved. So rehabilitation and restoration, again, those are updated terms from Department of Ecology's guidance, as well as riparian area. Seismic hazard areas, that's a definition from the WAC. Shorelines, now we didn't full-on delete it. We wanted to clarify and make sure it was documented as to why those items were removed. We still do mention shorelines in this code, but more as a reference. We added a definition for significant tree, and I think we may have discussed this last time. It is something that is brought up in the wetlands chapter, and we never had a definition for it, so we have added one that is consistent with the region looking at other codes and what is in place. So that's the definition that we have proposed for significant tree. Special flood hazard areas, that's an update to from FEMA. Those are required zones that we now have in the county on our flood insurance rate mount. There's user activity, found its way home in 660. And see, we removed the definition for unavoidable and necessary impacts simply because if it's unavoidable and necessary, it would include mitigation. So that was removed. And utility corridor definition was changed because we don't actually identify utility corridors in our comprehensive plan as the definition implied. We do encourage them. So we've just updated this definition to be in line with what reality is. And then those last two definitions there, again, are from the Department of Ecology's updated definitions from their guidance materials. Any questions before we moved on?
Yes, I'd like to go back to something that has not changed, but it's just the number. Okay. The reasonable alternative. Means an activity that could feasibly attain or approximate a proposal's objective. There is a condition I can perceive where the proposal's objective is inconsistent with protecting the critical area. And it says here, but at a lower environmental cost. Well, the example I gave before of the rural protection 1 to 5 persons, reasonable alternative was go to 4 because that actually is lower than the 5. But in truth, that is a requires a significant impact on the critical area that would still meet the definition of reasonable alternative. That's a concern, another card on the table, folks, that we'll talk about when we get there.
So moving on into wetlands, chapter 200.
Let's do it, Roshan.
All right. So the first thing you'll notice is that we have moved the term regulated, removed it throughout just because by the simple fact that we're talking about it, it is regulated. It's in the regulations, so that's been removed. In A, under 205, notice that we've added maintaining and enhancing when required. So enhancement is not something that it's only necessary through mitigation purposes. So wetland mitigation or enhancement isn't a requirement otherwise. So then the wetland identification and functional rating in 210. The definition was removed here at the beginning of section 1 simply because it is the definition. It's already in the definition, so to simplify it, pulled it out of there. And clarifying that all wetland delineations, they no longer use the Washington State Manual, as we discussed last time, but rather the approved federal manual and regional supplement. So there are changes made throughout this chapter to reflect that. And then also the already in effect as well is the wetland rating system that was updated in 2014, used to determine the category of wetland. Category 1 being the most functional and ecologically significant, and Category 4 being wetlands with the lowest level of function and often heavily disturbed. Changes were made to the point system used to categorize wetlands, and Ecology Field calibrated the method using 111 of their original reference sites. So compared to the 2004 rating system that was being used, they found the number of Category 1 and Category 4 wetlands remained about the same with both rating systems. There were slightly fewer Category 2s and slightly more Category 3s. Primarily what we see in Kitsap County tend to be Category 3 wetlands. So this table here shows what the scoring system will look, how it looks now, because this is actually already in effect and being used by Kitsap County. There were, you'll know that there are some exemptions in for Category 3 and 4 wetlands. The square feet allowed for that has changed down to 1,000 square feet from 2,500 feet for Category 3 and down from 7,500 square feet to 4,000 square feet for Category 4. And this is, again, off of Department of Ecology's guidance materials.
And so again, Kathleen, the guidance reflects what the state is saying best management practice, best available science is. When you say we have the guidance, that's what we're looking at. Best
there are multiple science. Documents that Ecology right. has provided, particularly right. for wetlands. So when I say guidance, I'm referring to a suite of documents Range. That they have provided. Yes.
And the guidance would include things like reducing the square footage that is subject to exemptions. That's correct. All within this guide.
Correct.
If Is there a way for members of the public to look at the guidance to kind of get a sense for, you know, this isn't something staff is just coming up with. This is here it is, and here's where you can find it.
So on the website, right next to the drafts, there's the summaries of best available science, and it references the publications that are available online for anyone to review.
And they're awfully fun to read, so I advise them.
I appreciate that.
So moving on to what was Section C, the non-regulated wetlands, that's been removed simply because it is now in the definition of wetlands itself as well. And Section D, the criteria for determining wetlands divided by a man-made feature, that's all in the wetland delineation materials. And so rather than create an instance where we're not lining up with that, we've just simply removed it because the wetland biologist who's trained in that method would know what those rules are. So moving on to 215, wetland review procedures. So the application requirements on NA, we've clarified in an introductory paragraph that all applications for development within a wetland or buffer will include at a minimum the wetland delineation report and the wetland mitigation report. And in what was, let's see, or in B, the delineation of wetland boundaries, we removed that first part there because, again, it's redundant to previous sections.
I just had a quick question about the existing language. How often do we require a survey? We get a wetland delineation in. How often does the department require a survey beyond that? Is it normal, usual, or is it on rare circumstances?
A survey for, because there's a delineation survey.
Well, there's a delineation that's done, mm-hmm. and then the existing code also provides when required by the department, the applicant shall also hire a professional surveyor to survey the wetland boundary line. So you want that, I'm just wondering how often that.
That is the wetland delineation report. That's.
Okay, so that happens every time, the survey requirement.
And that's the wetland biologist that would typically do that, so it wouldn't be a survey company necessarily. So moving on then to C, the wetland review process for single-family dwellings. Under 1, we've just clarified that expedited approval is not the same as expedited review, which is sometimes available for additional fee. Expedited approval being that if you follow the greatest of the buffers, then the permit can move forward quicker. Then in subsection C on page 48, a survey is not required, and clarifying again, with a single-family wetland certification form. Just a point of clarification there. 220, wetland buffer requirements. So we've added an introductory paragraph describing how buffer widths were determined using the tables that follow. And the new tables give more direct answers to what is the buffer than the current tables would do with, you have base buffer and then you can plus or minus. So this sort of lays it out, and the tables are now by category of wetlands. So once that's been determined, you can go to that table for your category of wetland and determine what that buffer would be. So most buffers remain the same, with some of the following exceptions, which we did go over last time, but I will go over again as well. For the Category 2 wetlands, high-functioning score with moderate land use impact, currently 200 feet to 225. High-functioning habitat score and high land use impact, currently 225 up to 300. Category 1 wetlands, high functioning score with high land use impact, currently 250 going up to 300. Coastal lagoons with moderate land use impact, currently 200 going to 150. Coastal lagoons with high land use impact, currently 250 going down to 200. Moderate function score with high land use impact, currently 200 going to 150. And those are just the category 1 and 2 wetlands that are seeing those changes. Moving on then to the rest of 220B, the modification of those buffer widths. So the first thing I would like to point out is under 1E, the minimum buffer width at any point will not be less than 75% of the widths established after the categorization is done and any buffer adjustments applied. So currently right now that would be a 50% buffer reduction through buffer averaging, and ecology's guidance again is saying 25% is the maximum that they would support.
Now, if I could just go back to the start of B, we've added provision for modification after using all available means, we show that alterations cannot be avoided, minimized, or mitigated. So in terms of all available means, I've never, that kind of language, if available means would include not using it, not doing what I want to do. What are we referring to with all available means?
I'm sorry, could you, where's this?
Yeah, so it said we can't modify at B, the new B, modify buffer widths.
Mm-hmm.
I can't have a modification of buffer widths unless I first demonstrate by using all available means that I can't, the change of the buffer can't be avoided, minimized, or mitigated. When you say all available means, what kind of things are you talking about?
Well, we've got current examples right now for like single family residences where the driveway, you can't realign the driveway to avoid the impact just because of an existing easement or ingress onto the property. So those would be examples of where we would start looking at.
So you say, can we move the driveway?
Can we move the driveway to a different alignment so it's not arcing into the buffer of a wetland, for example? Can we realign it someplace on the lot?
Are there any further comment on the buffer averaging? So then under section 2 on page 54, the administrative buffer reductions, this is similar language that we have for 1, for buffer averaging, A and B. We've added a new subsection C, which is to allow buffer reduction for those high-intensity land uses to those recommended for moderate-intensity land use. And as you'll recall, there were those situations in the Category 1 and 2 wetlands where we were saying it was going to go up for those high-intensity land uses. This would be a means for that to be reduced down to what's recommended for the moderate land use intensity buffer in those situations. And so, for example, if the wetland scores moderate or high for habitat and a vegetated corridor of at least 100 feet is legally protected between the wetland and another priority habitat area, and then the measures that are in the table in 220F are applied, then you could go move down to the lesser buffer. any comments? And then 225 additional development standards under B, there's the agricultural restrictions. Development proposals that would introduce or expand agricultural activities. A net loss of functions and values to wetlands shall be avoided. So again, this kind of goes hand in hand with the previous definitions that we're going to be taking a closer look at. The additions to the road and street repair and construction under 225C were added for clarification primarily. And then D for land divisions and land use permits. We deleted the master plan fully contained communities and master plan resorts. Those are no longer in code, so we wanted to get those out. Trails and trail-related facilities in F, very similar language that we have for the Shoreline Master Program, again, to sort of be consistent, viewing platforms limited to 100 square feet without a wetland mitigation plan, trails generally limited to the outer 25% of the buffer except for crossings or direct access to viewing areas. And I apologize, there's a typo that next F should actually be G for utilities. And those edits were for clarification. 6A, the use of lead-based paints shall not be used, not should not be used. And 6B, when approved, we say they may must be applied by a licensed applicator, not just herbicides, as it says now. As you'll see, that section is not just limited to herbicides. It includes pesticides and other things as well. So we wanted to be all-inclusive to that section. And there's 230 was crossed out, special use review, again, moved to chapter 100 for use for more than just wetlands. Hmm. 250, wetland mitigation requirements. So we retitled this mitigation sequencing, that's what it is, and all impacts to wetlands or buffers shall be mitigated according to this title. Again, it's the impacts we're mitigating for, not the regulated development activities. And the fifth element on there under three, excuse me, A5, was removed because by combining any of the above measures to mitigate for individual actions, we don't want people to jump to that. It's if you're moving through mitigation sequencing, you would have a combination of those things. So if these are in order, that didn't make sense. So that's been struck. So the mitigation report, B. Clarifies that when a report is required, and then that the notice to title is the acceptance mechanism. It currently says notarized memorandum of agreement. That, to my knowledge, hasn't really occurred. So notice to title is the appropriate mechanism to accomplish that. And the mitigation for wetlands, that has been moved to the special report section because it is very specific about how the mitigation plan and report should be put together. So that's moved to the special report section. The wetland replacement ratios in what is now C. You'll notice, and I believe we also discussed this previously as well, but it's clear to see it in the whole table in your draft. So under the reestablishment or creation and enhancement category, the enhancement ratio for that particular option has gone up. And again, these are ecology recommendations from back from 2005 that were not provided in time for the previous update, but are now being considered. And I would say that the department may increase or decrease the ratios under specific circumstances, which are listed in C2, and under A, it talks about what are the standards for increasing those ratios, and in B, what are the standards for decreasing those ratios.
Did I see in here that the mitigation must occur within the wetland that is within the watershed area that is being impacted? Is that in there anywhere? If we're considering mitigation.
When we get to off-site mitigation,
okay.
We do, yeah, it does cover that. Alternative mitigation plans under D. Under 1, this is a new section. The county will consider mitigation plans that demonstrate equivalent or better level of protection of wetland functions and values. So we are providing an opportunity to do something other than the wetland ratios if you can show that it's being as good or better for ecosystem functions and values. Then we talk under 2 for the off-site compensatory mitigation. And DI, we've added to the existing statement that we had for mitigation banking that was at the end of this chapter and pulled it into here, as well as created a new subsection for the in-lieu fee program. Currently, we only have that available in the Hood Canal watershed. But yes, this is an example of where it would need to be within that same watershed. Also added the advanced mitigation. So for projects that have pre-identified impacts to the wetlands, you could do advanced permitting responsible mitigation following ecology's guidance manual for that process. And then 260, incentives for wetland mitigation. Buffers dedicated as permanent open space tracts may qualify for the open space taxation program. There may be other circumstances that would lead to it not qualifying for that program. So just to clarify, it is not a will qualify, but a may qualify. Okay. So that's it for the wetlands chapter and all that we were planning to cover tonight. Taken your notes and concerns, and we will be looking into that further.
Right. And, well, thank you, Kathleen. So we should expect the rest of it, phase 2, next time.
Yep. So next work study, April 18th. We'll hope to cover those topics. And that's all I have for this evening, unless there are any further questions or comments.
Okay, next item we have on our agenda is findings of fact, Planning Commission rules of procedure. And
Mr. Vulture. We do have one member from the public that wanted to comment on the CAO. I don't know if you want to do that for the good of the order or now. But,
yeah. Without objection from the commissioners, certainly let's have the public give us an input. Since this isn't a formal public hearing, we kind of keep it short and sweet. That'd be great. Right.
Because your public testimony is still being received until actually early May, I took advantage of submitting more detailed comments than I gave you the other night. Words are important, and the comments about the weeding and moving of land. In other codes, when you move land, 10 cubic yards is the threshold for a permit. So we should be we should be consistent with the rest of the codes, is my concern. When you use the words any and all, that means something. I included for you a copy of this of the reference that's quoted in the draft for danger tree, and it says when it's a danger to a worker. Talks nothing about buildings, so that's a Kitsap County creation. The list of threatened and endangered species is included. Is it? Turn this thing on again. Is it on switch or somewhere? I'll just leave that there. You want to read that. It's in the reference, so just look it up on the web. It's easy to find. Reasonable use is not defined. You talked about that. The list of threatened endangered species, I question whether there's any here that need buffers. Look through that. If there's no species listed that need buffers, the question comes, why the buffers? What are we serving? We have the authority through court cases to not have buffers if we justify it. We're required to have benchmarks. That was promised a dozen years ago, the last time we did an update, and it didn't happen. And that's now a court case requirement, and I've included it. Best available science is required to be included in the record, but we don't have to follow it with justification. You'll see all that in what I submitted. Pretty simple. And hope you enjoy the reading. And I know this is a lot of fun. We've all been through this drill before. And yeah, I've got the copies for you over there. Maybe I can pass them out.
I appreciate it. I know we all know you, but just for the record, let's make sure we identify you more.
Yeah, I'm Mike Gustafson. I live in South River. Okay. This is one of my favorite topics. Okay. Poor Jim Bolger, I know, has suffered with me on this. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
We'll give you those copies.
Thank you.
Celebrate the things we share.
All right, moving on then to adoption of findings of fact and recommendations regarding the procedures.
All right, so I'm filling in for my coworker, Scott Diener, who is now probably luxuriating on a beach down in Mexico someplace with his family, but
good.
Yeah, good for him. So before you are tonight are the findings of facts and recommendations to the Board of Commissioners on the adoption of rules of procedure for the Kitsap County Planning Commission. Those were in your meeting packets that include kind of the Department of Community Development findings. There are four of them stated. I'm not going to take the time to read through those. I'm sure you've already had a chance to look at it. But we have included the amendments to the rules of procedures, and I just wanted to run through those real quickly just to kind of affirm the findings from the last meeting where you took action on the amendments. The first amendment is for Section 6C. And that section as a whole was the conduct of business, and it just added some language there in terms of the minutes, audio recording, and findings. And then the final sentence there, findings shall not be approved the same day as deliberation and voting without the unanimous consent of the Planning Commission. The next amendment was 7A-2, and that was for the section on reconsideration, and we just added a textual change in the very last sentence that the reconsideration motion must be heard and voted on at the same meeting. Amendment 3, as you recall, there was quite a bit of consideration of this segment. It was in 9Q, and that was the section on meeting rules and procedures, and we did a fairly significant change there that every member of the commission present, when a question is put to vote, shall vote on the question unless the member has recused him or herself due to a conflict of interest or is allowed to abstain from the voting by this bylaw or any other applicable law. And then the fourth amendment that was adopted was in the ground rules section and was really identified as general ground rule number 1 and just made a textual change on the last sentence that meetings will start on a timely basis. So I think our little kerfuffle at the beginning of today's meeting, we still made the timely basis for today's meeting.
All right, is there any questions? Do I have a motion?
Move approval of the findings of fact and the rules of procedure.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, Mr. Bolger. Thank you. Okay, any comments for the good of the order? Okay, do I have a motion to adjourn? Do we need a motion to adjourn? Okay, meeting's adjourned. So that was my 15 minutes of fame. I've done it now. I'm on bucket list.